your question regarding how was it to work for Shelby, it just depends on the day. Peter and I shared an office, and it was right next door to Carroll's. And we didn't close the doors in those days unless he was meeting with Ford or whatever. So, but we could tell what mood he was in by the tone of his voice and the loudness of his voice. And we knew that when it was a good time to ask for something or when's a good time to stay away.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a new edition of the award-winning Talking About Cars podcast, where it's all about everybody has a car story, from celebrities to car personalities. I'm Randy Cardoon. Thanks for joining us this week. Our Talking About Cars podcast will originate from the Dr. George Car Show in Palm Desert, California. Now, this Dr. George is not to be confused with the former weathercaster at KABC. This Dr. George is a doctor who raised money for local charities in the Palm Springs area with a car show that attracts not only some really great-looking classic and custom cars, but also some well-known car celebrities. Like Peter Brock and Alan Grant, they are big names in auto racing. Both having worked for Carroll Shelby during his heyday making Cobras and Mustangs, Brock was the automotive designer, having some big influence on the mid-1960s Corvettes as well as the Cobras, while Grant was the longtime race car driver using Shelby Cobras in many car races. I was joined by my pal Bob Beck from Great American Auto Scene, or GAS, with two A's. Bob joined us in the desert, and Brock talked about his new book, The Road to Modena.
Well, this new book is really pretty interesting because it covers all of the cars that I did for Carroll after the Daytona Cobra.
Oh.
And one of the most interesting one was the last car that we did in combination with Alejandro Di Tomaso that was planning to run into the Can-Am days. And then, of course, Ford Motor Company came in and took over Shelby American, and every project that we planned on working on got killed off. There were several other major projects, and this was one of them. So it only ended up as a pretty piece of art, never turned a wheel in anger, but it was still one of the most exciting cars that we had a chance to build.
All right, and other cars that you built, what would people remember or know of?
Well, the most well-known, of course, is the Daytona Cobra that we won the world championship with, and I did the Bill Mitchell Stingray for Bill at General Motors in 1963. But I had a chance to work for Triumph, did a really beautiful prototype TR250K, which became the TR7, which you see on the street, and did several other little cars like the GT350 Mustang, which is primarily doing the exterior work on that. Of course, the car was just originally a basic Mustang, but we made that into the race car that was, I think, probably turned out to be Carroll Shelby's most successful car because we built a lot of them.
Right now, in reading about that car, and I wasn't aware of this, you started out as a hot rodder like many of us here in Southern California, and the paint scheme on the GT350 came from your custom that you built.
Well, actually, my hero in when I was going to high school was Briggs Cunningham, because he was the first guy to take and run American Racing Colors at Le Mans, and he'd run them on the several years that he ran over there, which was a white car with blue stripes. And I thought that was so cool when I was in high school that I put that on my 46 Ford, which is chop channeled and sectioned, and it was really a pretty cool looking custom. But nobody had ever seen anything like that. And then it was interesting when the opportunity came up to do the redesign on the car for Shelby for the GT350. I had done some more complicated things that were going to take too much time and cost too much money. So they decided not to do them. So they were at a loss what to do it. I suggested, well, I think the most important thing we could do to make the car really visible out there is put a couple of stripes over the top. And the Ford marketing guys looked at that and they said, oh, no way, nobody will ever buy that. It looks like a skunk. And then we compared what it was going to cost to do the stripes versus all the other work. And they said, well, you know, those stripes look pretty good. So we ended up putting them on. And, of course, now they've become the standard racing stripes. You see them on every car that Detroit comes out with, which says performance.
Yeah.
Hey, Peter, when you bought your Falcon sedan to Liberty, you put those stripes on there. Was that before the Mustang?
Yes, about the same time.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. That was very distinct.
Is that what, 63?
63 Falcon, yeah.
Yep.
So it was 2 years before we did that. And that car now resides up in the Cobra Museum up in Boulder, Colorado.
For some people who don't know a lot of your past, let's go back a little bit. And where did that automotive love come from? Where did you get interested in the car when you were growing up?
Well, I was 12 years old when I got my first job working at a job kind of cleaning tools and sweeping the floors at a sports car shop in Sausalito, California. And, of course, all the guys at that time were building and racing their own cars. People didn't have trailers at that time. They drove their cars to the races. So I got to go to the races with them. I used to, you know, bicycle over after school and work in the shop and got to see some neat cars being built. And the most important thing was that I got to see some specials being built. At that point, it was the first time I'd ever seen anybody really make something, you know, fabricate it. And from that point on, really, the guys that do fabrication have always been my heroes.
You raced a number of different cars. You were not just the designer. You were the guy behind the wheel as well. And you had some really interesting cars in the early days of road racing.
Well, you know, I always wanted to be a racer. And that's just like Alan. We both went to work for Shelby. And he was the smart guy, figured out how to get a seat in one of those cars. And that car is sitting over here. That really put Alan on the map and showed Carol what talent that he had. But there were several of us that went to work for Carol, and hoping to be race drivers. And I ended up running a school for him. And like they say, if you can't do it, you teach. So I guess that's
What was it like to work for Carol Shelby?
I'll tell you, that's probably one of the most complex questions I've ever had. He was a Pied Piper. He put together probably one of the greatest teams of guys in the world. But it had ups and downs. There were very complicated days working for Carol. And so I've got good stories and bad stories. But it was, I'll tell you, a great, great era. And America wouldn't be what it is without Carol's name in it.
Alan, I'm sure you've had good stories and bad stories. Feel free to give us the juicy stories.
Well, on your question regarding how was it to work for Shelby, it just depended on the day. Peter and I shared an office, and it was right next door to Carol's. And we didn't close the doors in those days unless he was meeting with Ford or whatever. So, but we could tell what mood he was in by the tone of his voice and the loudness of his voice. And we knew that when it was a good time to ask for something or when's a good time to stay away.
All right.
By the way, let me just give you a little background. Peter and I were just talking. I went to work for Carol in January of 63, and one of the first persons I met was Peter Brock. And we've been friends ever since. And so consequently, I went to work as a welder and then went to work in the fab shop and the race car shop. Then they found I had a couple years of college, and they moved me upstairs and gave me the title of production control manager. And Peter and I shared an office. And I can tell you right now, this guy, Peter Brock, is finally getting the credits and he deserves. I mean, everything about Shelby. He was the first employee right behind Joan. And he was the first employee. He did the logo. He did the graphic arts. He did everything about Shelby, the advertising. You look at George Bartel, all those early advertising, you know, Peter brought George Bartel in. It's amazing what this man has done, and I'm proud to call him a friend.
Well, of course, Carol provided the opportunity for it because we were growing so fast. Now, you know, there's a lot of great legend about Shelby, but you got to realize that when we first started out, we were just half a dozen guys there, a bunch of hot rod guys, and pretty much turned the world upside down. But they were the very best guys. You know, Phil Remington, probably one of the greatest race car builders in the world, came to work for Carol. He'd been working for Lance Reventlow in building the Scarabs. And when that shop got turned down, the IRS was kind of down on Lance because they weren't making a profit there. So Carol moved into that shop, and with it was Phil Remington. And Phil Remington, I think, was probably the most important guy that we had in the whole place, because everything that was a success that Shelby made goes back to Phil Remington.
All right, the Cobra days were really important in motorsports, but let's go back to your start. you talked the Art Center into accepting you. You did a sales job. You got yourself into a really famous school.
Yeah. I'd heard about this. I'd gone to college, and you know, I was doing okay, but I really, my love was working on cars and wanted to be around race cars a lot. And I'd heard that there was this school down in Los Angeles called the Art Center College of Design. And I didn't know much about it, but I'd heard that they taught how to design cars down there. So on Easter vacation, I drove down there and walked in the back door with all the students and kind of sat in the classroom for a couple of hours and saw what was going on and said, man, this is really the coolest place. This is where I want to go to school. So I didn't know much about the school, but I just walked up to the front office and said, I want to sign up and go to school here. You know, what's it cost and whatever. And the lady was very nice, and she explained to me that the Art Center College of Design is a school where professionals go after they've been in the industry for several years, and they come back to polish their skills and to get a lot higher. And I said, yeah, fine. Where do I sign? She says, no, you have to bring your portfolio in, and it'll be, you know, judged by, you know, whether we can accept you or not. And there was kind of a long silence. And to show you how green I was, I said, what's the portfolio, you know? So she explained that you have to have some examples of your best work. So I said, okay. So I went out in the parking lot for about 2 hours. I opened up my folder there with the blue lines, you know, with the and sat there and doodled cards like I did in study hall. And at the end of the day, I took them back in, and I said, well, here's my portfolio. And, you know, I literally talked my... They must have needed a check at the end of the month there or something, but they said you can have 6 months here, and if you can make it, you can stay. And fortunately, I had an incredibly good... instructors there, and also a lot of help from the guys that were going there. I mean, these are guys that were already professionals in the industry, and they could see that how passionate I was about designing and building cars, and they really helped a lot. And it was the same thing. I never finished up school, didn't have the money, but by then I'd got to meet Chuck Jordan, who was the vice president, became the vice president of design at General Motors. And at that time, he was a headhunter for him. So he'd come out to the school to see which of the top students in the eighth semester that we're going to take back there. So I got to know him, and so when I got sort of cut off on funds on school, I called up Chuck and said, hey, is there a chance that you can have a guy that's only halfway through school? And they sent me an airplane ticket, and I went back to General Motors at 19 years old. And again, timing was everything. I got to work for Bill Mitchell on the Corvette program, which had been just cut off. Management had decided they weren't going to build any more Corvettes. They'd been losing money on them. But Bill Mitchell was a wild man, decided that we were going to do the car in secret, and he couldn't do it up in the Chevrolet studio. So he brought it downstairs to the advanced concept design we call Research One, where they put all the young new designers for an evaluation and gave us the project down there, and that's how the Corvette got resurrected. So I designed a car at Bill's direction. I don't want to claim that I designed it under his direction. And when that car first appeared in public, it just absolutely turned the world around, and management decided that the Corvette would go back into production. But if it hadn't been for Bill Mitchell, we wouldn't have Corvettes today.
And that was quite a beautiful car, but there were always discussions about the mechanicals of it, and the weak point being the brakes.
Well, the only weak point really was the brakes. But it was very interesting because Zora Duntoff had...
That's kind of a significant part there, Peter.
Well, we'll get to that point here. I'll show you what happened. Right. Zora Duntoff had gone to Harley Earl after they'd raced the stock Corvettes the first couple of times, and they were too heavy and a little cumbersome, and Zora Duntoff said, you know, what we've got to do is build a really modern prototype. So what we did is, under the advice of Tony Lapine, who eventually became the head designer at Porsche, at that time was a board man there at General Motors, he talked them into buying a 300 SL. We took the body off it, and because that 300 SL had a large kind of six-cylinder motor in it, they pulled a couple of tubes out, we dropped the V8 Chevy in it, And on the top of that car, we built the SS Corvette, which is a beautiful, beautiful car. But it was so beautiful, it took too long to build it. They didn't put enough development time on it. When they took it down to Sebring, it only lasted a few laps because they couldn't talk the GM engineers into putting disc brakes on it. And this is 1957. Jaguar had already had disc brakes since 1955. That's what enabled them to win at Le Mans in 55. But they couldn't talk the GM engineering into doing that. It was just too radical an idea. Other than that, the car was very fast. They put Juan Fangio in the car. He broke the lap record in the car. They put Stirling Moss in the car, and he broke the lap record. But it would only go about three laps before it ran out of brakes.
All right, Alan, you've had a lot of experience. And one of the experiences we talked about earlier this morning was you drove a car called the Cheetah.
Well, you're being very gracious calling it a car. But, yes, I did.
Tell us a little bit about that, because that was supposed to be the Cobra Killer.
Yes, it's kind of ironic. My big race, as Peter mentioned, was at Riverside in 1963, where I showed Shelby I could drive, and Bill Thomas was there. And, of course, Shelby had promised me a ride on the factory team in 1964. But at the time, I was going to get drafted, so I ended up having to go into the I joined the Army Reserve and had to go in for 6 months. And during that period of time, of course, they'd already run Daytona and Sebring, and they had the USRRC team put together. So I came back, and Shelby says, you know, Alan, I got the team already put together, but I need you upstairs. In the meantime, Bill Thomas had called me and wanted me to drive the quasi-factory car, a guy named Alan Green out of Seattle, Washington. And so consequently, yes, in May, I raced up at Kent, Washington there, and then we ran that car the entire season, including going back to Canada at Mossport, and then Riverside, and then Laguna Seca. And so consequently, I got a little segue in there about brakes. This car had stock car brakes, Sinster Metallic drum brakes. And so consequently, you had to get those babies warm. And so at the start of the race, again, this was a GT car, you know, running with Jim Hall and Roger Penske and Bruce McLaren and all these cars. So I qualified out of 30 cars. I think I was probably about 16, 17. I was fairly well back in the pack. Well, meantime, another guy named Jerry Grant was driving a Lotus Chevrolet that Alan Green also was running. And so he and I got together before the race, and he says, what's your strategy? And I says, well, I says, this car's running real good. And I says, I think with a little attrition, I said, I might be able to get a top 10 finish. And he says, well, that makes sense. And so anyhow, they dropped the flag, and we took off, went through turn one, got up into turn two, and I kid you not, the entire pack almost stopped. And I came down on the brakes, and there were no brakes. And so fortunately, I was on the inside. I pulled to the inside, and there was enough room, and I went from 17th or 18th up to about 5th, past Jerry and the whole world. And so afterwards, Jerry says, what in the hell were you doing? I says, I didn't have anything to do with it, but I was able to pass all those cars and get up front, so I didn't stay there long.
Well, I think what we've learned here is sometimes having no brakes is a good thing.
Well, if you want to turn right, just give it more gas.
Right.
Yeah. Now, you did win a race with the Cheetah.
Yes, I won a couple races, regional races. My best finish was at Laguna Seca, and I still hold the track record, you know, for the fastest front engine car, you know, on the old track.
So. Wow. That's cool. We were just passing through Laguna Seca a couple of weeks ago, and we wanted to stop. But it was a non-car weekend, so we didn't.
Oh.
Now, what other great cars? You know, you had an interesting crew chief.
I'm sorry?
You had an interesting crew chief, or at least that's what it
says. Oh, yes. Actually, I grew up in Modesto, California, and there's a guy named George Lucas that also grew up in Modesto, California. I was 4 years older, so I wasn't really in school with him, but we had this little club called Ecurie AWOL. And if you look right underneath the executor sign on my Cobra, that's our emblem. And we were a bunch of young guys, and we were running around all winter long. We took the tops off, and all we had was windscreens. And we had these big peacoat jackets that we'd put up on top. And when I turned 21, I had an AC Bristol at the time. And I got that thing set up. In fact, I think I was the first one ever to put anti-roll bars on an AC chassis. And so anyhow, I put anti-roll bars in that car, and I was autocrossing it. And I got to the point where, I had that car and I, were one. If it's possible to have an intimate relationship with the mechanical option, that car and I were one. And I knew exactly what it would do, and it knew what I was going to do. And so then I turned 21, ended up racing it, won 12 out of 14 races, went all the way from Del Mar up to Seattle. And George went to every race with me. And so at the end of that season, I went back to college. And then during my semester break, I've been reading about Shelby and Competition Press was going to put in a small Ford V8 and an AC chassis. Well, I knew the AC chassis inside and out. So during semester break, I went down there. And then when I became production control manager, I was responsible for selling cars and actually ordering cars from AC. And my biggest dealer, Coventry Motors in Walnut Creek, called up and wanted to buy a race car. Well, I only had one rebuilt race car. And I told them I'd sell it to them under one condition. And they said, well, what's that? And I said, I'd drive it. And it got real quiet on the phone. And finally, I said, they asked if I'd ever raced. And so, fortunately, the Coventry Motors is in Walnut Creek in Northern California. I said, call SCCA. I was rookie of the year. And they told them all about it. And I said, furthermore, I said, you got to put up an extra $600. I want to build a special engine. I want to blow off the factory team. Well, that really got him excited.
And so, you did.
Yes.
So back in the day, did you have a clue that George would end up doing what he did with Star Wars and all those other movies?
You know, it's kind of ironic. You know, when I called George when we got the Cobra, he came down and slept on my couch in Santa Monica. And at the time, I still have some big cardboard pieces where he actually had lasers and explosions going on. And I didn't think anything of it. George was just a little guy, but he was always jabbering. And so consequently, one of the guys says, hey, told him one time, hey, George, can you just shut up for a while? other than the fact that those drawings that I have, so I had no idea.
That's cool. Now, the Cobra that's parked over there, is that the one you've had all along?
I'm sorry?
How long have you had that particular Cobra that's over there?
That actually is a car that I bought in the 80s. The original car, CSX 2128. Actually went up for auction in 2004, and it sold for $2.2 million. They thought it was going to sell for $900,000.
Wow.
That car today is probably, I'm sure it would probably bring close to 10, because the car, it's the winningest Cobra. Dan Gurney drove that car at Sebring in 63. Dave McDonald drove that car in the USRC series in 64. And then I had it, and then Coventry Motors sold it back to Shelby, and Ken Miles drove it in 64.
Wow, the history of the Cobra and racing
in
those
days. It's kind
of
ironic. Bomé Mercier actually picked up on this car. And then Superformance also produced what they call the Sebring Cobra. And they made it, in the Sebring livery. They made it in the my livery and Dave McDonald's livery. And they've been very successful with that car.
All right, Cobra Roadsters. I've always loved them. But my preference is the first generation.
Totally.
Yeah, the small fender car.
Absolutely. In fact, Ken Miles and I were talking one day, and he says, you know what? The best of all worlds would put a small block, in the new 427 chassis, which is basically a 4GT suspension.
Yep. Of the cars that you were involved with, which was your favorite at General Motors?
Well, of course, at General Motors, it was only the Stingray program because I was only there for about 2.5 years through that whole program, and it was a very exciting time. But again, the whole corporate thing about trying to go racing with General Motors, they kept trying to suppress their racing program all the time, and when they finally suppressed it totally, it was time to leave because there was just no racing there. So I came back out to California and went to work for one of the great heroes of Southern California racing at that time was Max Balchowski, who built the old Yellers. And that's actually where I met Carol, because Carol had won the Le Mans race in 1959 at Le Mans with Roy Salvadori, and he wanted to finish up his last season in 1960. So he came out and drove the old Yeller for several races. And I went along and accrued on that for a while, and that's how we got together, and I ended up running his race driver school for him.
Great. All right, we've got a lot of people out here right now, and Randy's going to go out if anyone's got any questions.
Anybody have any questions?
Raise your hands,
like,
and Randy will come to you. Okay,
Peter,
all the way in the back field.
Let's go in the back. Thank you for coming up. Why don't you stand up for me? What's your name?
Mike.
Mike, where are you from?
Anaheim, California.
All right, Mike, go ahead.
P- Peter, I wonder if you would talk about your aerodynamic philosophy for the Cobra Coupe and the resistance you met with.
Well, the design inspiration for the Cobra Coupe was actually done in 1937 by the Germans. There was a young guy at that time named Reinhard König von Fauschenfeld, who was another very famous aerodynamicist named Paul Jarret, who had worked for the Germans in World War I and had actually designed the shape of the giant Zeppelins and figured out what was the shape on them that gave the best aerodynamic drag. And so those Zeppelins, when they started out, their advantage was if they could get above the airplanes, because the airplanes didn't have enough power to get up high, and they could use them to bomb. But they weren't very fast, and when they had to come down, the airplanes would shoot them down. So he designed a better shape for them, and that was his claim to fame. So every car that you see out there right now with a beautiful fastback on it, that all came from Jarret. That's called a Jarret influence, any car with a fastback. So Jarret also got interested in motorcycle racing, and as he was racing, obviously he was very aware of what the air was doing over his body and figured out that there was less drag with flat panels that didn't taper. So he began to study on that, and while he was going to school, he came up with a project to design a bus for the Autobahn. And he made this bus that was actually a little bit longer with a tapered tail and a chopped-off tail on the back end. And it was so much more efficient, and it could carry more people on it, that the German industry under Hitler became very interested in what he was doing. So he had applied for a patent on this, but they wouldn't give it to him because he had not yet finished his schooling. So they said, we'll let you work for Dr. Vunibald Kham, who at that time was the world's most famous aerodynamicist, way, way ahead on what was going on. So Kham and von Fauschenfeld came up with some ideas with absolutely flat panels, because any time that you have a surface, if you can build an ideal surface where the surface does not deviate from the flow of the air more than 7 degrees, the air will stay attached to it and creates less drag. The minute you turn it like a fastback, like we're talking about, like Jarret did, the air begins to turbulate off the side and create drag. So for an example, if you take a Volkswagen bus, as blocky as that is, that has a coefficient of drag that is better than an E-type Jaguar coupe. It's that the E-type has less frontal area and is a little faster, but a VW bus actually has a fairly good shape to it because all the sides are flat, the roof is flat, and the air stays attached till it gets back where it's cut off. So obviously, manufacturers, at the time that all these beautiful, graceful cars were being built in the 30s, especially by the French, the idea of building a car and chopping the tail off was so ugly that no manufacturer would take the risk to do it. So it wasn't until later, when we got farther into trying to make cars much faster and more efficient, that I took the ideas for that and put them into what we call now the Daytona Coupe. It was interesting because in Italy at that time, there was another young guy my same age, a guy named Ercole Spada, and he was working for a little carrozzeria in Modena, up in northern Italy, and he built a little car called the Alfa TZ1. And if you look at the Alfa TZ1, it looks almost identical to a Daytona Cobra because he'd studied the same papers that I had found in the that the Germans had written. So we designed two cars at the same time that looked the same, came up with the same idea and separate things. So Spada, who never got any credit for what he did under his name, but you all know his name as Zagato. So all the beautiful cars that came out of Zagato were designed by Ercole Spada, and he got it from the same influence on the German design.
Any other questions for Peter Bark?
Right over there. John.
John Kramen, excuse me. From Mecham Auctions, John.
I would like to ask Peter to tell us his thoughts of having some experience with the power plants, both the small block Chevys in that time period versus the small block Fords. I'd like to hear your comments comparing the two, please.
Well, obviously, Ed Cole was the first guy to really design overhead valve motors for General Motors, did the Oldsmobile really in 1949. And that went down, did really great in the Mexican road race, and they did the Cadillac engine, and then he shrunk the whole thing down. That became the small block Chevy, which has become probably the most successful racing engine in the world. Ford countered with that idea to build a lightweight cast block for a V8, and it actually was designed originally as a 221 cubic inch for the pickup trucks that they were building up in Canada. And that's when Carol first heard about that V8 motor, and the people at Ford had told Carol it would, at that time, had become the distributor for Goodyear tires and had gone back to Pikes Peak to demonstrate the tires and show some of the teams back there what they were doing. And he met some of the officials from Ford, and they told him about this new lightweight engine that they were building. So Carol had heard also, of course, that AC was their engine supplier was Bristol, was being cut off, put two and two together, and that's really how the Cobra came about. So by the time we got the first Cobra that was built on the West Coast, the engine had been expanded out to 260 cubic inches. Now, a lot of people think that Carroll was the first guy to put the Ford small block in the Chevy. It wasn't. Actually, Ack Miller was the first guy, a very famous California hot rodder, was the first one to take an AC Bristol out to Bonneville and ran it with a V8 engine in it. So that's really where that that whole idea of running V8s came from in the Bristols, in the AC chassis. Also, Carroll wasn't the first one to put the engine in California. Actually, Ed Hugus, who was going to be his Eastern dealer, had already done the job back in Philadelphia, and that car was taken to Ford, and they showed what the potential was. And by that time, the second car had arrived out at Dean Moon's shop, where we Carroll had his shop going at that time, and we put the first 260 cubic inch V8 in it. The reason that that Carroll has gotten most of the credit for doing that is that Pete Peterson and had put out the magazines at that time, Hot Rod Magazine and Sports Car Graphic, which are the first really magazines that went out to the public after Road and Track. When those editors got hold of that car and started publicizing it, the car became really quite famous because it was much faster than the Corvettes at the time. So that engine worked out very well. It got a lot of good development with our team at Shelby's, and everything that we had three engine teams building, and they all competed against each other. And then the best ideas that each one of those teams would develop would go into the next series of engine. And that's why when we ran our engines in 1963 and 64, we were pretty much unbeatable in American road racing. The problem was that General Motors management would not allow any real heavy factory-backed teams. They were still paying a lot of guys under the table to run at NASCAR, but there wasn't very much going on with road racing, with the exception of Jim Hall. And, of course, Jim Hall came up with all of the great ideas that were banned. Every great idea that Jim Hall came up with, the Chaparrals, got banned because it just would have put the rest of the guys that were out there racing, would have put them out of business and would have cut off racing. So there are a lot of stories that we don't get to hear about.
How much horsepower was Shelby getting out of the small block Ford?
We were getting about 385 horsepower out of the 289s, and that's what we ran all the way through 1964 when we ran the United States Road Racing Championship. You could get more horsepower out of them, but they wouldn't last quite as long. And later, of course, they made some more high-performance equipment. But Ford put most of their money into the big blocks that they were running at NASCAR at that time.
Car designer Peter Brock and race car driver Alan Grant. Hey, remember to subscribe to our podcast on radio.com, iTunes, and KNX1070.com, as well as Apple Podcasts, so that way you can be notified when a new Talking About Cars is uploaded and you won't miss a thing. And if you're on iTunes, please rate us, give us 5 stars, and leave a comment about what you think of the podcast, kind of a review, if you will. Our website is talkingaboutcars.net, and don't forget to follow us on social media. That would be on Facebook, along with Twitter, and on Instagram. And also, you could follow Bob on Great American Auto Scene, or GAS, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. Until next time, I'm Randy Cardoon. Join me as we have some fun talking about cars.